listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and what's going on in what I call our total health environment, the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the health of our political system, and the health, the ecological balance or lack thereof of planet Earth, our habitat. So each week on the show, we discuss different facets of all of these interconnected things that impact us on an individual and family level. And, of course, we range quite far afield on that. The show has been around now, I think we're going into our eighth year pretty soon. So we've had a lot of great guests, and today we have one of them who is returning. So I just want to urge everyone, check out the archives, because it's really a wealth of, you know, smart and activated people sharing information, and today's guest is one of them. I think this is her third or fourth visit, but who's counting, to Connect the Dots. I'm delighted to welcome Jean Marie Duray. Jean Marie is a political consultant and Illinois State Coordinator at ERA Action and a long-term, very savvy activist whom I have known for a number of years through a whole bunch of the permutations of, you know, bringing about progressive agendas and supporting and electing progressive candidates over and, you know, progressive policy solutions, you know, putting those forth over a number of years. Delighted to have you with us today, Jean Marie, and we're going to be talking about the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, which is something that you've been active in for a number of years. So welcome back to Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. You know, like, here we have all of these different things happening, both in the public space and in the public space concerning women. You know, there is the Me Too conversation, which we, you know, when folks began to try to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, that wasn't part of the picture. You know, there's always been misogyny and, you know, patriarchy and other problems, but it seems even now that our awareness of these problems, the awareness of women and of men and everyone who's concerned, has really heightened. You know, but the ERA is something that's been around for a long time. So I guess I have to ask you, why is that initiative an important potential solution for us to focus on passing it now?
Well, I think, you know, it's always been important to pass it. I mean, whether we're talking about, you know, 1923 when it was, you know, first introduced, or we're talking about 2018 right now, women's issues, women's rights, and going back then, the right to vote, these things have always been a problem in the sense that women have never had full equality, have never had a place in our Constitution. And as we look at the trajectory of women's rights over time, we do see it, of course, getting better, but we still have not achieved full equality. We haven't even achieved full pay for the work that we do on the most basic level. So, you know, is now the time? Yes. Was 1972 the time? Yes. Was 1953 the time? Yes. It's always been the time. It's just that we haven't had the support for whatever reasons to complete this task and bring women into full equality in this nation.
Let's talk a bit, for those who may not be that familiar or need to revisit the topic, what passage of the ERA would do? And, you know, in other words, if there was a national consensus and that was passed, what would be happening?
Well, initially, ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment doesn't really do anything aside from putting those words into the Constitution stating that you cannot discriminate against a person on the basis of their sex.
Mm-hmm.
So that is all that it does. It doesn't mm-hmm. change anything. However, what it does do is it allows for legislatures and the United States Congress to go in to make laws where women aren't just protected, but they become a protected class. And what that means is, for instance, if right now you went into a court and you said, as a woman, I am being discriminated against, here is the proof. The court would say, okay, you're being discriminated against. However, there's no law that says we can't discriminate against you. So it ends there in a sense. Now, if you are in a state or a municipality where there is a law that says that you cannot be discriminated against, when you start talking about what that, how that bears out, well, the next problem is you know, passing constitutional muster for a protected class. So now that means that if I'm going to take this to a higher court and say, yes, I've been discriminated against, you now have a higher burden of proof because you're not a protected class under the Constitution. That means that not only do you have to prove discrimination, but you have to prove intent. Intent in any situation is always difficult to prove. And intent in a discrimination case becomes much harder to prove, almost impossible. And so many times these cases go nowhere. And, of course, then that expense falls with that woman or group of women who file that case.
Mm-hmm.
So this becomes a big problem. And this was part of what played into a number of years ago, the Women of Walmart case, where it basically, you know, this was one of the issues involved in why it was dismissed and not heard by the Supreme Court, which was, you know, you can't prove intent that, you know, this was just circumstance. So you're not a protected class. You've got nothing to go in there with. And it really takes the power away from women to even be able to have a voice to say that they're being discriminated against. If you have that constitutional amendment in there, intent is no longer an issue to the courts. It's merely proving that you were discriminated against, intentional or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see why putting in intent is kind of like saying, this person murdered this other person, but he wasn't feeling maliciously toward him at the time.
Right. And how would you know how they were feeling at the moment? You're not in their head. And so you can't do anything about it.
Right. Right. You can only deal with the action. Right. So this basically is a way to directly assess and, kind of manage incur the repercussions for performing that action, which then, you know, functions to dissuade, others, that person or others from doing that particular action. So that makes complete sense. Now, this doesn't kick into effect until, you know, a certain number of states have passed the amendment. Is that correct? In other words, it's like lining up and saying,
yes,
I support, our state supports this, we want to do this, and, you know, when we reach this particular benchmark, then it will be. How, where are we in terms of that benchmark?
Okay, well, backing up a little bit,
mm-hmm.
the way this shakes out and is set up is first that the you have to introduce the amendment into the United States Congress, and they have to approve it.
Mm-hmm.
And this happened in March of 1972. Now, it was not by surprise, and people should really understand that. I think some of our older listeners probably understand that because they were there at that time, but some of our younger listeners, I don't think, fully mm-hmm. appreciate how inevitable people believe that the Equal Rights Amendment was at that time. So
mm-hmm.
when the Congress approved it in 1972, that amendment had already been introduced into every session of Congress for the 50 years prior.
Wow.
So it was not a new idea. In fact, the first person to introduce the amendment was a congressman from New York who was a nephew of Ms. Stanton, who was, you know, who was very well known as, you know, one of the beginning mothers of the women's rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
So the amendment has been sitting there all this time, and suddenly with the movement of women, of the women's rights movement in the late 60s, early 70s, it was finally understood that this needed to happen, and it was going to be moved through the Congress. And with that knowledge, states and government agencies, both at the federal and state level, begin making preparations for this to happen in advance of the amendment being ratified. So, for instance, the Social Security Administration went ahead and changed verbiage in their, you know, in their statutes. Things that said, you know, like benefits for a widow were changed to benefits for a spouse. You had little word changes put through there to neutralize language so that it was not based on sex. Even in the state of Illinois, we had a constitutional convention here prior to ratification, back then, where we changed the, you know, the state's constitution and made the actual wording of the Equal Rights Amendment a part of our state's constitution. So these things were all done in advance of the congressional approval of the amendment in March of 1972. When that amendment went through, we literally had states approving it within 24 hours of approval in the Congress. So, I mean, it was rolling through New Hampshire and Hawaii and things literally within 24 hours and being ratified immediately. The bulk of the state who did ratified it within those first few weeks. So it was really amazing. The country was ready for it and they anticipated it. And states that you wouldn't anticipate now jumping on board and getting it done, like, say, Alaska or West Virginia or Kentucky or Tennessee. These were in Texas. These were states that jumped on board and ratified it right away.
And once they ratified it, then they're done. They ratified it and they can't take it back, and that's that. So it only moves forward, or can they take it back?
That's an interesting question, Allison, because right now some states, like Tennessee, have since changed their mind about it and voted to take back their ratification. At the same token, however, in U.S. history, states have done this before, but it has never been recognized because, according to our Constitution, there is no mechanism for taking back your ratification. Now, with the Equal Rights Amendment, we fully expect that this is going to be challenged again in the courts. But again, the legal precedent is that a state cannot rescind its ratification. So basically we had this period where it began rolling through. Now, what ended up happening, we need to get through 2/3 of the states in order to get that ratification in place. And when the 2/3 has been attained, you then have a 2-year waiting period in which everything kind of comes together, and they move that language into the United States Constitution. That being said, there was one odd thing about the Equal Rights Amendment that almost never happens, except when there is controversy in relation to the amendment. And the thing that happened was is that they put a deadline onto the Equal Rights Amendment, a deadline of 8 years. This was unusual. And everybody, because it was moving so quickly, did not pay it too much mind. However, at the same time that the Equal Rights Amendment is barreling through the country, Roe v. Wade is happening.
Mm.
And suddenly, for reasons that still do not make a lot of sense to me, but those opposed to abortion,
mm-hmm.
and those who were for abortion, decided to link the Equal Rights Amendment to Roe v. Wade.
Mm.
And so
explain exactly what Roe v. Wade is to our listeners, please,
sure.
Jean Marie.
Roe v. Wade is the Supreme Court case that created the standard for legalization of abortion in the country. Up until Roe v. Wade, abortion was not legal in much of the U.S. And the case was decided on a right to privacy, basically the right to privacy between a woman and her doctor and being able to make that decision in regards to that woman's health.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly Roe v. Wade kind of opened up a Pandora's box in relation to the ERA, when really these were two very separate issues, one being decided on a right to privacy in relation to the relationship between a woman and her doctor, and the other being a civil rights issue that was being handled by constitutional amendment. Now, the other thing that then happened was a woman named Phyllis Schlafly, who actually is from Illinois, becomes part of this beginning thought of far right thinking. And I say the beginning thought of far right thinking because the Equal Rights Amendment actually was Republican held legislation. In fact, Republicans were pushing it at their national conventions in the 50s and the 60s, and Democrats were the ones hemming and hawing on equal rights for women. So Republicans had held this legislation. Republicans had pushed it very hard. Republican women were doing the heavy lifting of fundraising in order to create the awareness. This was a Republican piece of legislation, end of story. And it took a lot of work to get Democrats on board. So now, suddenly, Phyllis Schlafly comes in. And again, this is the beginning of this far-right thinking. This is, you know, the time of Nixon. This is the time of the Powell memo. This is the time when Nixon brought in a board of corporate advisors for the first time into the presidential circle. So this is the kind of the beginning of where we have ended up now in terms of corporate power. And so as this is happening, Phyllis Schlafly comes in and she begins the campaign to stop the ERA. And they link it to abortion. And they link it to women serving in the military. And they link it to unisex bathrooms. And they link it to gay rights. And they link it to a whole bunch of things that the country may not have felt they were ready for.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that was the direction we were headed in.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, after 2 years of this constitutional amendment rolling through and barreling across the country, when we finally got down to a place where we only had a handful of states needed to complete this, the Stop ERA organization under the Eagle Forum, under Phyllis Schlafly, in fact, did stop the ERA, and it stopped moving.
Mm-hmm.
The advocates for the Equal Rights Amendment then went back to the United States Congress and asked for an extension of the deadline. So it was extended 2 more years to 1982. They needed 3 more states to complete this. They believed that the next state that they would go to would be Illinois. And they did. Here in Illinois, the amendment went to die. There were protests in our state capitol. People, there was a group of women who chained themselves to the doors of the capitol and went on a hunger strike. There was pig's blood thrown across the center floor in the rotunda of the state capitol, where they wrote the names of the leadership who they felt had sold them out on the Equal Rights Amendment, including a Republican governor at the time. And the protests were massive. The marches were massive. And it was interesting because, well, people I know equate Illinois with Chicago and a big city. The fact is most of the state is very rural, and it is a long four-hour drive through cornfields from the northern side of Chicago down to Springfield. So it is really driving into nowhere. And for people to have flocked to this place in nowhere and to have created the amount of protest that they did in relation to the ERA not being ratified is a tremendous thing.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, it was rather ironic that suddenly we couldn't get this passed in a state that had put the wording, the exact wording of that Equal Rights Amendment into our state constitution just prior to the movement for ratification. So here we were here we were 10 years out and it failed. And when it failed at that deadline, we were still short three states. The states that had not ratified at that time, when the deadline passed, going from west to east, were Arizona, it was Arizona, it was Utah, Nevada, Louisiana, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, North and South Carolina, and Florida. And, of course, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So these were the only states that had not ratified. And we needed three of them. And after the failed passage of the amendment, in the United States Congress, congressional members still were trying to introduce the Equal Rights Amendment again, introducing different versions of an Equal Rights Amendment, introducing more encompassing versions of the Equal Rights Amendment, and introducing legislation to extend the deadline. And none of these measures gained any traction or gained any interest, because what we ended up having by the time we get to 1980, which is when the deadline was extended to 1982. What we end up having, and most people, I don't think, have a full understanding of this in this country, is the abortion debate became the primary center of the battle in relation to women's rights. And when you look at the presidential election in 1980, you're going into a presidential election with an incumbent Democrat who is a Democrat who was against abortion at the time, which was Jimmy Carter, and a Republican Party that really had not staked out any space in this, as well as a Democratic Party that had not staked out any space in this arena. So the Republicans, with their candidate of choice, which was Ronald Reagan, began what was this far-right Christian coalition the religious right that we have today. They created that along with this pro-life story and made that their story to move their candidates forward. They would be the champions
kind
of the pro-life movement.
Entire issue. Yeah, I remember that. I have a specific reason. I remember that very well because it was like, gosh, in fact, I'll I'll never forget it. It was a very seminal turning point. At the time, I was a television producer. I was working with a nationwide network of independent television producers, you know, much like the independent media of today, but working in documentary and television news and that kind of format. When we were collaborating together and working with the public television system to bring live coverage of major issues, you know, of various sort, in a combination of, you know, sort of live and pre-taped. And we actually, in 1980, traveled to, our team all gypsy-like, went to Cincinnati, Ohio, where we were covering a right to life convention. And this was the first time, you know, really, that there had been this kind of upsurge of the right wing. We went behind the scenes and we saw all their organizing, their direct mail letter campaigns. They had a very weird guy who was masterminding that. And at the time, we got this advanced view of what a, you know, pseudo-military, very well-organized right-wing organization, very well-funded, would look like. It was on, you know, sort of exploiting the, you know, the abortion issue. And when we first did it, and this is, you know, the first of many, many life experiences in the news media, where you find out about something that other people, you know, earlier than the rest of the population that's not, you know, doing another job and they're not looking into this. And so we were very aware of this very frightening thing that was rising up. And, you know, when the show was aired, you know, people saw it. But, you know, usually if you went around in different circles and were talking about the fact that this was going on, people were completely unaware of it. And I actually ran into a colleague of mine from that time who was part of that production. He was our executive producer at that time. We did a number of shows together. I ran into him in, I guess, around, I don't know, maybe 2010 or so, around 8 years ago, at a media conference in Minnesota, and I hadn't seen him, you know, for, I don't know, like 20 or 30 years at that point, probably. He now had gray hair, and, he, you know, he and I were elders of the new young social media and media generation. We spotted each other across a group, and before the current activity, there had been, you know, many years of inactivity and kind of deadness in the media before the current era where we have people making YouTubes and documentaries and films about all these topics. There was just a big silence, you know. And so when he and I greeted each other, you know, after all this time, I said to him, wow, you know, here is the next generation rising up on these very same issues, you know, in the media. You know, I said, and we were back there in the day trying to prevent this. This was before we had what we, you know, had hoped to prevent happening now. And he said, yeah, but we didn't prevent it. And, yeah. You know, I think people didn't see it coming. But, you know, and no. Sorry for this long kind of detour, but this is like, you know, it was a historic moment and another, you know, of many instances where people didn't see it coming. And, you know, we saw yeah. it because we were right up there interviewing, filming, you know, this newly organized, you know, and motivated groups on the right that skewed the entire issue of overall women's rights toward a struggle about, you know, the right to make personal decisions in healthcare versus not for pregnancy.
Right. And I think it's, I think, no, I think your comments are really important to have in the conversation in the sense that this was an orchestrated move and it put us where we are now. And it is in large part why these battles continue to exist. I mean, the Reagan campaign of 1980 is the first time we get the meme of the black welfare queen. That didn't exist before Ronald Reagan's campaign. Those were the words coming from him in his campaign. And so, you know, it's not just a demonization of women, but particularly black women. You know, it's the beginning of the demonization of women, of minorities, of people who are in need of assistance, Yes. It is the beginning of a whole host of attacks on the American populace, not to mention the middle class and other things that we're, most of us, I think, are very aware of. So this was occurring. Now, over on the other side with the Democratic Party, you had this division occurring in that Jimmy Carter was pro-life, but now is an incumbent U.S. president in the Democratic Party. He was being opposed by Ted Kennedy, who was coming at this from a pro-choice stance and taking on that mantle against the Republicans and within his own party against the incumbent president. And this kind of solidified what was going to happen because Jimmy Carter was on his way out. He had not been a strong president or a strong presidential candidate going into that race. Ted Kennedy, you have a strong family of Democrats with a strong history coming in, championing women and minorities and the downtrodden, a long history of that, coming in and saying we're gonna pick up the pro-choice side of this, and so it set the stage for where we are now, in that we have a mm-hmm. pro-choice party and we have a pro-life party, and
mm-hmm.
that split the women's movement. Because the other thing I think many people do not realize at the time Roe v. Wade was passed is that the majority of people in this country were not in favor of abortion. It was something we hadn't had. The women's movement was new. This was a new way of thinking, and people weren't necessarily ready for it immediately. It took the wind right out of the women's movement. It created sharp divisions, and some of it's only healing now, 40 years later, 45 years later. It was a big implosion of everything that was going on, and it was devastating to the women's movement. And so here we were. The Roe v. Wade was being fought. The Equal Rights Amendment had passed the deadline, and we were three states short. Legislation was continuing to be introduced through the 80s and the 90s in the Congress, and nothing was happening. And so in 2012, a group of women that I work with came together and began what is known as ERA Action. They live in Ohio. It is a ratified state. But they, one of them was old enough to have worked on the, and protested and tried to move the original amendment. The other one was a bit younger, but still remembered it from being a child at that time. And so they were very passionate about it, and they began to work on this issue. And several months later, I was contacted by them. And at the time, I was working on national legislative issues and doing a lot of activist work on a national level. And they asked me to come in, and I was more than happy to join them. We then went to the United States Congress to find sponsors for the piece of legislation we wanted to see moved, which was to get rid of that deadline so that we could finish the work. So we did go through a few sponsors. The ones that we finally ended up settling with, they were the ones who would continue to hold the legislation to this day. Was in the United States House was Congresswoman Jackie Speier out of California, and in the Senate, Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. Now, in the Senate, it was interesting because we began with two chief co-sponsors introducing the bill just before Mother's Day and sending out letters to their colleagues urging support. And the second senator at that time was Congressman Mark Kirk of Illinois, who was a Republican. Now, his term did not last, and so we now have just the two Democrats as the chief sponsors in both chambers. But we began trying to move this legislation, and believe it or not, we did have problems getting Democrats on board again, which was just astounding to me.
Why was
some
that?
Of them didn't take it seriously. Some of them didn't take it seriously, and we had others who were in favor of a start over bill, which would mean we'd have to start the entire process over again. And given what the landscape looks like in this country right now politically, with state houses and the Congress, I don't know how we could start over and be successful anytime soon. But they were in favor more of going with a start over bill sponsored by Carolyn Maloney out of New York in the House. And Republicans were more than willing to get onto that bill because they knew it had no chance of succeeding at this time. So we had no Republican support. We were having trouble with Democrats getting them on board. We worked it for several years and finally got to a point where we did have fairly strong Democratic support. We felt at the time before Republicans took control of the Senate that we could probably get it through the Senate. But the House was another issue with the Tea Party takeover that still continues to this day. In the meantime, however, we did have the Congressional Research Office do a report for us to find out whether or not it was feasible for us to go ahead and get the last three states ratified in spite of the deadline existing. So the Congressional mm-hmm. Research Office did the report for us, and their statement in the report was that, yes, getting the legislation done to remove the deadline is the easiest way. However, yes, you could continue to ratify states while this deadline existed and then push the legislation through that removes the deadline, and it would still count. They also stated that if we were to go to court over it and fight the deadline, that we may have a chance of winning that, being it there, again, is no mechanism in the United States Constitution to institute a deadline on a constitutional amendment, particularly when you look at the 27th Amendment, which had to do with congressional pay increases, and it sat mm-hmm. unratified for 203 years. 203 years, and they ratified it. Now, we all thought the ERA was going to be the 27th Amendment, but no, it was about increasing congressional pay. So, you know, again, it shows, you know, the trajectory we're on in this country. So the Congressional Research Office basically gave us the green light to move forward. So we began examining which states we thought we had the best chance of moving things forward, talking with people in those states, people in those legislatures, and trying to figure out where we should start putting down roots in order to move this case of ours forward. So our first plan of attack was for Virginia and Illinois. We thought those two states had the best chances of passing it based on the makeup in their state house chambers as well as the support within those states. So we begin there, and the big problem we ran into in Virginia was that the state house was slightly more Republican than Democrat, and the biggest problem we had was we couldn't get it moved out of committee in the Senate ever. So the women in Virginia worked extraordinarily hard. We had a number of organizations we were working with on the ground there. One of the primary organizations was Women Matter, and tried very hard to move it through there. It was just upsetting because it was so close, and they knew that they probably had the votes in the chamber to get it done, but they couldn't get it through the committee. And that's been on repeat for three sessions now. Really upsetting. In Illinois, we begin to move it there. Now, in Illinois, we had a really nice in that Representative Lou Lang, who was part of the majority House leadership, had been reintroducing the ERA for the last 20 years. He had a real stake in this. And I began working with him, and he suggested that we need to find a sponsor in the Illinois Senate. And he suggested that I pursue Senator Heather Staines. So I did have many talks with her across several months, and she finally decided to champion the ERA for us in the Illinois Senate. And we were easily able to move it through the Senate. But again, here in Illinois, the sticking point was the House, and we made several attempts with groups of professional lobbyists, activists, our team from ERA Action, us literally spending weeks in the Illinois State Capitol trying to help move this. We had funding from an ERA group in Florida that funded us. So a lot was going into this, and we still weren't getting the results we needed. We could only get a handful of Republicans, and in fact, the sticking point ended up being pro-life Democrats here in Illinois.
Hmm. Amazing.
So we went back and forth for a number of years. So this year, what changed was a number of things. First, last year, through the work of so many women's organizations that wanted to see the ERA pass, there was a huge movement to get as many women stacked into that state house in Nevada as possible, one of the other states that we thought might have a chance, but we certainly didn't think we had the kind of chances we ended up with. And what happened was is that they turned the tide and they got an inordinate number of women brought into the state house during the last election in Nevada. And it changed the makeup dramatically of the state house. So Senator Patricia Spearman in Nevada ended up championing the ERA under this new guard in the state house. Their Republican governor, newly elected, quietly supported the amendment. He felt it was good to support, and they were able to set it in to such a situation that they were able to choose the day on which they were going to pass it. They were able to choose the fanfare that was going to be around it. They were able to make all these choices because the support was so strong, it was inevitable that they would ratify it and be the first ones to ratify in over 40 years. And so they planned to do their ratification on March 22nd, the anniversary, the 45th anniversary of it being introduced into the United States Congress in Nevada last year. And on March 22nd, they passed it. It went into the record, and they were the first to ratify it in 45 years. That meant out of the three states needed, we were now down to two. So we came back to Illinois this year and made the argument, hey, we've now got another state that has gone ahead and done this. We need the Illinois State Legislature to finally get on board and do this right. And so we, again, through our activists, through our lobbyists, and also through the added push from the Me Too movement and the women's mm-hmm. march that took place after the election, there was so much more fire to this than had been before, so much more awareness. And it was a tremendous help in terms of getting the attention of the people who serve in our state house to realize the people were now watching. And newspapers were now running articles on it. And the fire was spreading across the state. Even newspapers in downstate Illinois and these rural areas were running articles in support of the Equal Rights Amendment. So this was huge. Now, in the meantime, yeah. Phyllis Schlafly,
oh my God,
who ran the Stop the ERA campaign, who was still sending people into the Illinois State House to stop this while we had been working on it, she passed away.
Oh my God.
And so we were concerned because her family still runs the Eagle Forum. But what ended up happening was rather interesting and lucky for us, and that the children ended up in a spat over the estate that was left over and the mailing list for the Eagle Forum. And so the organization had been divided in two, and in fact, they're still in the court fighting right now. And so the resources are being squandered, and everything's kind of in a state of disarray. And so they were unable to really mount a very strong attack in response. And so as we went into the end of session before summer recess last week here in Illinois, on Wednesday evening, through the help of, believe it or not, Republican leadership in the state house in Illinois, there is a state representative, Steve Anderson, of Geneva, Illinois, who is very much a Republican of the old guard. He is a fiscal conservative, but he is very much social justice minded. And he very much believes in truth and reason and fairness. And he decided to become one of the chief co-sponsors here in Illinois for the Equal Rights Amendment. And it was through his leadership that he challenged his fellow Republicans in the state house and helped to get them on board and got the leadership of the minority party, the Republican Party in that state house, Representative Durkin, to also get on board. And suddenly, on Wednesday night, without any notice to any of us, we were surprised when Durkin and Anderson, along with Lou Lang, the original sponsor, Democrat, all came to the floor to speak in favor of the ERA and getting the ratification done that night before they went on summer recess. And
wow.
So half of our pro-life Democrats came out of the woodwork and voted for it. It wasn't enough, but the Republicans came to the rescue and they shorted up. There were Republicans that I spoke to personally, like Representative Pritchard, who had told me he could not vote for it. He believed in it, but he couldn't vote for it. There was no way he could vote for it, but he did. And so it was really, wonderful. I can't really explain how wonderful it was. All those years of work. Of speaking to these specific people who said no, they couldn't do it, and seeing them come through for us and get the ERA done. And so Illinois became the second of the three states to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment 46 years later. Now we are down to needing one state to complete this ratification process. All eyes are turning to Virginia as the most likely state to have it passed, but, you know, Nevada surprised us before. And there are groups actively working on this in North Carolina, in Georgia, in Florida, in Missouri, in Louisiana. I mean, so there are a number of states where who knows what could happen in the next year or two.
Wow.
And so we're going to be watching that closely. But we do know we have the votes to pass it in Virginia if we can just get it through the committee. And so that's where it stands. And then, of course, what I'd like to urge every single one of your listeners to do is to make sure that they're contacting their congressional members and telling them to get on that bill to get rid of the ratification deadline. The bill is there. Contact Congresswoman Jackie Speier if they're in the House. Contact Senator Ben Cardin in the Senate, if it's your senator you're speaking to, and ask them to get on that bill to get rid of the ratification deadline for the ERA so this can get done once and for all.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. That's incredible. Well, you know, it would be a good thing. I mean, it actually, what would be the actual tangible effects, of having this in place at this particular time, when so much is under attack, what would that actually do if that were in the Constitution?
Well, suddenly, you know, you couldn't discriminate against women so easily. When women would bring forward a case, all they'd have to prove is that discrimination occurred. They wouldn't have to prove intent, as we've talked about before. But it also means that government programs can be used to enforce that. It means legislation can be put forward to enforce that. And while people think, oh, you could just repeal legislation, once you're talking about a constitutional amendment, it doesn't become that easy. Because, like, for instance, Wisconsin had an equal pay piece of legislation that they had enacted. And one of the things it did was protect women. Now, when Governor Walker came in, he made it a point to get that repealed. And so that piece of legislation was repealed. Now, if the ERA had been in place, people could have gone to the courts to fight that and say that women are a protected class and their pay needs to be protected. And under the current circumstances with no protections, there's nothing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So again, programs can be put in place. I mean, you know, when we had the Civil Rights Act move through and things were done to, in the, you know, both constitutionally and legislatively to protect the African-American community, they became a protected class. You didn't have to prove intent. You just had to prove discrimination. And so many programs were put in place to help create a more even and equal playing field. Now, we may not have achieved it, but it's certainly better in many aspects than it was in 1960. So, you know, that was why we had programs like affirmative action. You know, it is why we had programs with mandatory quotas, because you're trying to get to a point of equality, and you're also trying to get to a point of normalization. Because, see, if I live in a community and there's never been a black person or a woman or a Latino who's ever had a position of leadership, who's never been an elected official, who's never had a college degree, who's never been a CEO of a company, then everybody's mindset is that those people don't occupy those spaces in our society. And that mindset doesn't just rest with white males, that resides with everyone. I mean, you know, you think back to when Obama first took office and the young boy who came in there, who was also African-American, who, you know, rubs Obama's hair and he's like, you have hair like me. We need to be able to identify and know that we are capable of reaching those positions, that we have the ability to have a voice, to create agency for ourselves. We need to be empowered, and we are empowered when we see people like ourselves in those positions. And that is why things like affirmative action and government programs that produce these results and equal pay and quotas are often very, very important first steps in creating the kind of equality that is required in a multicultural society. And so the ERA has the ability to help create these spaces for women that haven't really worked out. And it's not just white women. It's black women. It's Latino women. It's Native American women. These women actually are experiencing much greater levels of discrimination, much greater pay disparity compared to their white male counterparts. And in fact, one of the other groups is single mothers. In fact, mothers in general, they're another group that sees an even greater pay disparity compared to white males. So, I mean, this is legislation that could help a huge portion, more than 50% of our population. And it's not just about helping women, because, you know, families are struggling right now. And if let's say I'm in a more traditional family where it's a mother and a father and two kids, and let's say that mother and father, you know, maybe one has a high school education and the other has maybe half of college completed, and they're both in the workplace, and they're struggling because pay is not great right now. Well, what if the wife is only making 75% of what she should be being paid? How is that impacting that entire family? So, you know, when we talk about, you know, the wage gap, it's not just about women. It's about the entire society. So when we talk about passing the ERA and empowering women, we're talking about empowering society. And we're talking about lifting up people economically. We're talking about the possibility of getting people off of social safety net programs, of contributing more to the tax base so that we're not in the kind of financial problems that we're in. We're talking about children seeing their mothers feeling good and confident when they come home in the evening from work, as opposed to feeling downtrodden and carrying those feelings with them into adulthood, of feeling they can't do it either. But maybe it's going to change that for a lot of children. When they see their mothers feeling more confident. And it's also going to change the perspective of men, in the sense that there's plenty of men out there who support this. But for the men who don't, you know, when their wife starts coming home with more pay, maybe they're going to realize how important it is. So, you know, when their daughter can go into the workplace without being harassed, When their daughter can go into the workplace, if something does happen, she has recourse. Maybe that's going to make the difference. So it takes time to get everybody on board, but this is probably the most important starting point.
Well, yeah, that's really incredible. I mean, you know, the thing that, and we only have, like, I guess another couple of minutes, so we can't really delve into this, but, you know, one of the things that has occurred to me in all of the stories of Me Too that have surfaced, at least at the level of the media, is that if women had, you know, economic equity, they would have a lot more independence and choices than, you know, merely to be beholden to organizations, you know, and authority figures, bosses within organizations that tolerate, you know, this anything from, you know, outright abuse, as we've heard about, to, you know, just kind of inappropriateness that wouldn't be so much of a norm if women had economic justice. And so,
absolutely.
And, you know, and one of the things about all these Me Too stories is, well, what do we do now? How do we change the landscape? And I think, as you point out, this is a really important step, and it's almost complete in, you know, a sea change in that landscape. We're coming down to the final 2 minutes of the show, so I just want to say how great it has been hearing about this positive step forward from you, Jean Marie Doré, independent political consultant who's been working on the Equal Rights Amendment passage and issue over with your colleagues for a number of years, and bravo, one state to go. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Oh, thank you for having us, and thank you for additionally giving voice and time to the ERA.
Definitely. You know, wish we'd had it 40 years ago. And,
yes.
You know, thank you, listeners. You can also help make this happen. If you're a resident of Virginia or North Carolina, the next two states that, you know, are working on this actively, most actively is, you know, there are others, but, you know, those are the two in the lead. Only, you know, one of you has to pull it off. If that's your state, be aware this is happening. Reach out to the groups that are supporting it. Reach out to your own people to help get this legislation out of committee so where it can be voted on and passed in the state of Virginia. If you care about women and equality, this is like a great effort happening now. So thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's Connect the Dots. We'll be back a week from today on Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm Allison Rose Levy with our salutation, which kind of changes week by week, but heads up, keep marching forward with an open heart and, you know, with the connection to all our relations as we march through these coming times and contribute as we seek to. Be well.